Aristotle claims that the city of man is a perfect community. Now, that doesn't mean a flawless community. It means a complete community. It means a comprehensive partnership in the good life, ordered by justice. In this view, citizenship is the status which gives a person the privilege of full participation in that partnership. For scholars of public life like me, this is where conversation begins. And when I say this is where conversation begins, I don't mean that we all have to think that Aristotle is right. I mean that the old pagan provided the backdrop for all subsequent discussion of the topic. That's what we mean when we say that something is classical. We don't necessarily mean it was very good. We don't necessarily mean that it was very old. But when we say that it set a sort of a benchmark for all subsequent discussion, you may disagree with it. You may disagree with Aristotle, but you can't ignore him and still be a participant in the conversation. Well, classical liberalism does disagree with him. It says that the city is not really a partnership in the good life, much less a comprehensive partnership in the good life, but it's merely a special purpose treaty among individuals not to interfere unnecessarily with the private pursuit of the good life. And in our day, that has changed so that now even the individual is even deemed to be competent to decide for himself what the good life is, and this is often associated with the idea that there is no natural law at all. Well, even apart from that, just taking it in the older formulation, the problem with this view, that it's really about the private pursuit of the good life, it's not a comprehensive partnership, is that the most important human goods are not purely private. The most important human goods are not purely private. We're social beings, and that means a lot more than just that we need to help each other in order to have shelter, or to help each other in order to have food. All of the important human goods implicate other people, and except for this society together, we can't flourish. To be enjoyed at all, the human goods require traditions and institutions. There is no such thing, for instance, as a purely private marriage. We understand this as a public institution. Institutions require protection by law. And in order to provide this protection, lawgivers have to make up their minds what these institutions are. For example, there's no such thing as a neutral conception of marriage. Laws that conceive it as monogamous put polygamy at a disadvantage. Laws that conceive it as polygamous put monogamy at a disadvantage. Laws that purport to be open to both monogamy and polygamy conceive it, in effect, as polygamous. They aren't neutral laws, they're polygamous laws. So in the end, I think, the liberal challenge to the Aristotelian view is not very interesting, except in the sense that all mistakes are interesting. Now, you may want to argue with me about that, and that's fine, but I'm not going to say anything more about it right now. Because in my view, the more interesting challenge to Aristotle's view is the Christian one, which starts from the fact that Christians are participants not in one, but in two partnerships in the good life. Or you might say, in a partnership in the good life and then a more embracing partnership in the good life. Because they are subjects, I'm still using Augustine's language, even though I began with Aristotle, they are subjects of both the city of man and the city of God, the commonwealth of this earth and the commonwealth of heaven, as St. Paul put it. And our primary citizenship, St. Paul again, is in the latter, is in the city of God. Although the earthly city has a certain importance, it does. It's not a comprehensive partnership in the good life after all, because it doesn't comprehend, it doesn't take in, it doesn't embrace, it doesn't include, it cannot provide for the goods of the heavenly city. Not only can it not provide for the supernatural goods, but within the limits of Aristotle's understanding, it can't even be friendly and cooperative toward them. That may seem a harsh statement, but, I mean, doesn't he allow for worship in the city? Well, yes, but the heavenly city, as Christians understand it, would really have to be viewed as a rival from Aristotle's point of view. Earthly politics, as he conceived it, is the master art of the good. And the heavenly city challenges that mastery. There is, in his argument, no division between church and state, jurisdictional or otherwise. The officials of the earthly city manage religious affairs, and they manage them as they see fit. This is really sweeping. We take from Aristotle the idea of a virtue ethics. But, you know, with Christianity, we find that whole different domains of virtue that Aristotle did not consider enter into the picture. What Aristotle, according to Thomas Aquinas, for instance, what Aristotle talked about, were now become the acquired virtues. By contrast, faith, hope, and charity are infused virtues. They don't depend just on habituation and on earthly efforts, but on the grace of God, on the grace of God through the Holy Spirit, made possible to us through what Christ did for us. Now, there is no ghost. Well, there are ghosts. There are ghosts of these ideas in Aristotle. But you don't find the doctrine of it. You couldn't. I don't claim that Aristotle is wholly without resources for understanding this problem. In the first place, he recognizes that because the human good is multifaceted, the earthly city is not a first-order partnership in the good life, but only a second-order partnership, a partnership of partnerships, an association of various less comprehensive associations like families, like neighborhoods, like trades unions, each of which has first-order responsibility for its own aspect of the comprehensive good. Aristotle doesn't claim, for instance, that the city, unlike Plato, he doesn't claim the city should raise children. Parents raise children and are more competent to do this, although there are certain things parents can't do. And when the kids are too old to spank, the laws of the city have to kick in too. Now, Aristotle knows that among these first-order partnerships are religious associations. Moreover, in a certain way, even Aristotle's thought concedes that the earthly city falls short of being a really fully comprehensive partnership in goodness, because in his view, in Aristotle's view, the highest good that is attainable to man is the intellect's grasp of the principles of being, of what is, of matters that transcend the merely human. The attainment of this high good seems to him to require detachment from preoccupation with the everyday aspects of the good life. And for this reason, it resists the various blandishments not only of business, but of politics itself. The result is a sort of a permanent tension between the city, which seeks to co-opt philosophy through ideology, and the philosopher who seeks to understand the city and ought to love it, but may not. Yet for all these insights, and I do credit them as insights, I'm not slyly trying to put him down while praising him, but for all these insights, Aristotle's equipment is not enough. The first problem is that the church is not like other first-order associations. If the doctrine of the church is true, it's not just a voluntary association of individuals for religious rituals. Rather, the goods for which it cares are real goods which transcend the goods for which all of those other associations care, including the state. It's not a natural institution at all. It is not even a natural institution which can be taken up into grace, as marriage is, for instance, because in the Christian view, besides the two natural goods that are attained by marriage, the turning of the wheel of the generations and the loving unity of the two procreative partners, the husband and wife, besides those, there is added the third good, the supernatural good, the sacramental good, the good by which the husband and the wife actually participate in that very love which unites Christ with the church and become a living emblem of it. So marriage can be taken up into grace, even though it is a natural institution, but the state isn't even that. The church, then, is a divine initiative which more and more penetrates mere nature. It is an entirely new kind of association. The second problem is that Aristotle thinks of religion strictly as a civic function, as a telling of stories that aren't really true, although they may have some truth in them insofar as they point to these higher things, as a telling of stories that aren't really true and a performance of rituals that aren't really efficacious, but which have the merit of taming the divine, what would otherwise be a divine madness, among inferior people who are incapable of philosophical contemplation, rendering that madness amenable to the city's purposes. By contrast, Christianity resists being tamed. It wouldn't consider itself mad, but it resists being tamed. It cannot be reduced either to a mere civic function on the one hand, although it's perfectly happy if the state should say, in the name of God, let us begin these deliberations here. It can't be reduced to a mere civic function on the one hand or to a mere philosophy on the other. Indeed, it speaks of a God who judges the cities and the polities, who mocks the pretensions of those whom this world may call philosophers, and who, in the torrent of his inexorable love, desires for us goods we have never imagined, even goods we may not yet be able to desire, and which in our present state we would tremble to conceive. So how might Aristotle be corrected? Well, some thinkers have put it this way. There's something to this. I want to modify this view, but there's something to it. Some thinkers have asked us to picture the goods offered to man as a two-story house. Old view. The first floor is the goods of nature. The second floor is the goods of grace. I sometimes imagine that this is what Aristotle might have said had he known the gospel of Christ. And some of Aristotle's view of the city survives the burning fire of the gospel, because although the earthly city's partnership in the good life no longer looks absolutely inclusive after such a correction, it still appears relatively inclusive relative to the natural goods, which by God's providential government of all things do present to us a certain integrity of their own. Well, much can be said for this opinion. The two-story house. Some people call it, instead of two stories, instead of making it an architectural metaphor, they make it a baking metaphor. We have two layers of a cake. And I'm not the only one who has criticized this. It has been sometimes held, for instance, that we ought to think of it not as a two-layer cake, but as marble cake, you know, with grace and nature getting mixed up in there. I want to say something like that. Much can be said for the opinion of the two-story house. It honors the distinction between the natural and supernatural goods that are offered to man. That's important. It recognizes the limits of our earthly powers. Are naturally powers. It allows us to respect the authority of the earthly city over its own domain without allowing it to assert mastery over heavens. It allows us to demand civic enforcement of the natural law, which is the law of God as reflected in the arrangements of creation, because the precepts of natural law are already matters of the basic precepts, not all the details of the natural law, are already matters of common knowledge. Deep down, doesn't even the murderer know the wrong of murder? And it rightly forbids demanding enforcement of the divine law. The law of God is more perfectly reflected in the arrangements of salvation, because this belongs to the discipline of the church and not the state. And because the recognition of divine law, furthermore, depends not just on the proper use of the intellect by our natural powers, but it also depends on the gift of faith. And after all, perhaps deep down murderers do know the wrong of murder. Perhaps deep down the mockers of their mothers and fathers know that they ought to honor their mothers and fathers, but deep down can we honestly say that the proud know that the meek will inherit the earth, that the comfortable know that the mourners will be comforted? And what about the rich? Do they really know that the kingdom of heaven belongs to the poor? Probably not. So as I say, much can be said for this opinion, but it isn't the whole truth of the matter. Why not? I want to say it isn't the whole truth of the matter. Why not? What does it lack? The answer is that it fails to do justice to the dynamic aspects of good and of loss of good, of how the good is affected by salvation history, of how nature and grace interact. So I think we need to expand our architectural diagram beneath and between the two floors of the house. We need to draw in a basement and a mezzanine. Let's begin with the basement. Man, after the fall, is injured, not just with respect to the spiritual goods, because his relationship with God has been undermined and broken, but even in his enjoyment of the natural goods. Yes, the natural law is common ground. His nature has not been destroyed, but this common ground is now slippery and hard to stand on because our shoes are wet with the dew of our evasions. Consider marriage, something like a true account of marriage, although perhaps only a thin one, is at least weakly acknowledged in almost all societies, I dare say all societies, but does every society live up to it? That's another matter. And I'm speaking only of the natural goods of marriage, not the supernatural good of sacramental marriage. Does every society live up to it? Scarcely any does. And denial takes extravagant and irrational forms. Somebody may say, well, I know I should not commit adultery, but you know, the neighbor lady is more truly my wife to me than my wife is, and so that isn't really adultery, you see. Or take, for example, the argument in our society that irresponsible sex, quote, doesn't hurt anyone. Now, I don't accept the idea that anything is okay as long as it doesn't hurt anyone. I think that that's an inadequate criterion of ethics, but let's just go with it for a minute. Two generations into the sexual revolution, after a full harvest of poverty, disease, divorce, mistrust, increasing mistrust, tension between the two sexes, fatherlessness, teen violence, abortion, and increasing violence even against the children whom we do allow to be born. We should know better. Doesn't hurt anyone? Nonsense. In order to normalize sexual incontinence, we had to normalize murder. In order to normalize one kind of murder, we had to normalize others. If we're going to do that, why not euthanasia? Why not assisted suicide? Why not consensual murder? We're now in the midst of another spin of the sexual revolution that started it all. And under such circumstances, it may seem utopian to demand the civic enforcement even of the natural law. That may be the ideal, but in practice, most of our energy will go toward merely the amelioration of its most grievous and damaging violations. Or maybe even not to the amelioration of the violations, but even only to the amelioration of some of their most grievous consequences. We are not even on the first story of the building. We are in the basement. Well, even now, though, not everyone is in the basement proper. Most people are somewhere on the staircase between the basement and the first floor. Thanks be to God that the sort of grace that makes that possible has been called by many names in Protestant tradition, too. It's sometimes called preserving grace. God keeps us from being as bad off as we would otherwise have been, considering the fall, despite ourselves. Perhaps we can persuade some of those people on the staircase between the basement and the first floor to climb up to a higher stair, even if only one. Perhaps we can persuade others at least not to slouch down to a lower one. The design of creation, you know, does work in favor of such persuasion. Sometimes we're discouraged and we think everything's against us. Well, you know, we've got a winning hand because we have, we believe, a true account of human nature, and these ways of living cannot satisfy us. The lower the stair, the more dismal it is. The higher the stair, the more opportunities for joy. On the other hand, the malice of sin works against such persuasion, because even though it's impossible to will anything whatsoever, except because it seems good to us, it's all too easy to insist on enjoying the good, in ways that violate its character and bring us to ruin. Now, of course, the fact that the house has a basement has long been recognized. St. Thomas Aquinas comments that sin, even though literally unnatural, comes to seem second nature to the person who is habituated to it. He quotes scripture, "They are glad when they have done evil and rejoice in most wicked things." And yet it's a funny thing. The basement has never fully been explored in the natural law tradition. I think that there are at least four reasons for this. First, the mystery of sin is not wholly analyzable. It is about something that is wrong, something that is deficient, something that is missing in the pursuit of the good. It isn't a substance in itself. Second, looking too much into dark corners is perilous in itself, for we might get sucked in. There's a kind of a magnetic attraction to thinking about evil, and it's an enterprise that probably should be undertaken only at need. Third, the development of theoretical immoralism, you know what I mean, right? In its various forms, moral anti-realism, relativism, nihilism, and so forth. The idea that the difference between good and evil is socially constructed or arbitrary or purely relative to the culture or to the individual. The development of theoretical immoralism has taken place with such rapidity in our own time that most Christian thinkers have not fully caught up. Those weren't the arguments that the ancient apologists had to deal with. Fourth, appropriate responses to public vice depend as much on prudence as they do on sound principles. And it's not at all the case that the ancient Christian thinkers didn't know this. They certainly did, quoting again from Scripture. Thomas Aquinas says that trying to accomplish too much for virtue through law, too fast, is like violently blowing one's nose. It brings forth blood. But enough of the basement. Let's turn to the mezzanine. We've seen how the earthly city, when left to itself, slips even below the level of natural good. Yet God never does leave it to itself. By his mercy, the natural goods are shot through, not only with the grace of preservation, but with anticipations of the grace of redemption. Even sometimes the pagans to whom the early Christian missionaries went sometimes said, "What must we do to be saved?" How did they know? They needed to be. At times, these anticipations allow the earthly city to live to a degree above itself. Even less is known about these bright mysteries than about the dark mystery of sin. But something is known about them, and they have their own relevance to Christian citizenship. A Godward longing is built into the human heart. There is a natural desire for something that nothing in nature can fulfill. If even the pagan Aristotle was right when he said that nature makes nothing in vain, then there must be some satisfaction corresponding to every longing. And if we have a longing which nothing in nature can satisfy, what can satisfy it? Doesn't that point beyond nature? As the author of Ecclesiastes writes, he has put eternity into man's mind. There's nothing surprising in the fact that the pagans whom St. Paul addressed at Athens knew that there is a God. So much could be inferred from creation. Much more surprising is the fact that they knew that none of their gods was this God, so sure of it that they had erected an altar to an unknown God. An indistinct, isn't it true? An indistinct inbuilt sense of awe clings to the mystery of human life itself. We don't just say, "This is good, I'd rather be alive than dead." There seems to be something more. The revealed truth that man is the image of God, granted, seems unknown beyond the Bible's sphere of influence, but even so, some dim sense of the sacredness of human life is found everywhere, and this toehold in our intuitions is the very thing that makes the doctrine of the Imago Dei, the doctrine of the image of God, so compelling once it is heard. Death doesn't merely frighten or disappoint us. Gee, that's too bad. It strikes us as sacrilege, as desecration. Why should it strike us so unless it's really true that we're made in the image of our Maker? There are a great many things of this sort, premonitions in our nature of supernature. Not realizations of it, premonitions of it. Consider our sense of beauty. Dogs don't contemplate sunsets. Guppies are not struck dumb with awe at the music of Bach. Natural selection cannot account for the power to be shaken by glory. I don't say it can account for nothing, but those distinctively spiritual characteristics of the human being it cannot account for. There is no adaptive value in them. Or consider, you know, yet glory does shake us. Why? Or consider the impulse of wonder. You know, wonder is more than curiosity. There might, to be sure, be survival value in seeking to know how some things happen. Maybe you'll be better at getting your next meal then. But we humans don't just try to find out the causes of things. We demand to know what they mean. We want to know about them in terms of their first cause. Such premonitions not only dispose us to seek something above our nature, they move us to seek something within our nature that is really a supernatural gift. Consider marriage again. As I said, two of its goods are natural, procreation and the loving union of the procreative partners. But to Christian marriage, a third good is superadded by grace, sacramental participation in the union of Christ with his church. That is why, when the grace of Christ entered the world, the dignity of marriage became immeasurably greater than it ever had been. Slowly at first, though inexorably, this strange upheaval gathered force. Not even the very corruption of nature, not even the fall, could defeat it. Base metal was transmuted into gold. Knighthood passed from the world, of course, but for a time even husbands thought of chivalry. Marriage became romantic. Imagine that. Not just a convenience, not just a way to get more kids to help you to farm the fields, not just something like that. It became romantic. The love between the husband and the wife was not just eros, it seemed to be more like erotic charity in its ideal. Considering this history, you would think that the moment a culture lost its faith, the moment marriage lost its sacramental grace in the beliefs and practices of most people, then the echoes of that grace would die too. Marriage would instantly revert to its former pagan state, if not sink beneath it. Well, we no longer do live in a culture of faith, and that is exactly what is happening, but even so, the reversion has not been instant. It seems to be gathering speed, but even so, it has not been instant. Three generations into the so-called death of God, two generations into the sexual revolution, one generation into pop culture nihilism, even now, most people want sex to mean something. They may no longer know how to recognize that meaning, but they're disappointed when they don't. The echoes of sacramental grace have not yet died away. Why haven't they? Well, that's a mystery. In what medium are these echoes reverberating? Well, no medium but nature is left. But that's my point. Nature was made to anticipate grace. Nature has a face, and her face looks up. Erotic nature is no exception. There was always something more to eros than mere sex could explain. Even the best of the pagans, such as Plato, suspected that. Even in its shame, so powerfully does nature point beyond itself that the strings of the lute preserve a faint memory of lost music. When the heavenly city bears faithful witness to the earthly, it prolongs and amplifies that reverberation, sharpening the longing for the music itself, and this possibility transforms Christian citizenship. It turns out that keeping the earthly city out of the basement is not our only work after all. We may be able to uplift its imagination by singing the music of higher things than it is thought of. And I believe that. Now, of course, although any man may apply to the Savior for dual citizenship in the city of God, nevertheless, the city of man can't simply turn itself into the city of God. And the echo of grace is not the same thing as grace itself. But even so, perhaps we might hope that by the influence of the gospel, the city of man might come to reside in the mezzanine. Arguments might become accessible to some of its residents, which were previously beyond their reach. Oh, I get it. I get it. They may come to hold loftier conceptions even of the merely natural goods than they formerly held. They may begin to glimpse in mere nature lights, shimmers, flashes that they'd never caught before, as when a lover looks into his beloved's face and sees more than flesh, but it is a true vision, as though he was seeing someone before the fall. Eventually, they may even see these goods nearly as they really are, not healed of all privation, not healed of all loss, not yet taken up into grace, but truly illuminated by it. This is why St. Paul remarked that although the grace of Christ is a fragrance from life to life among those who are receiving it, it is a fragrance from death to death among those who are perishing. And as we've been seeing lately, this seems to be true even of corrupt bishops in the church herself. We may end with three questions. The first, can the natural law be invoked in conversations in the public square? I don't mean saying the natural law says. I mean appealing to the natural law whether or not we use the name and the technical vocabulary of the natural law tradition, because it is rooted in our intuitions. Can it be invoked in conversations in the public square? The answer is yes, but it will often be resisted. If one wishes to have a reasonable conversation at all, there is no alternative but to invoke it, because it is reason applied to the way of our making. Yet the very appeal to reason in our day unleashes a variety of irrational sentiments, doesn't it? The second question, can natural law be invoked in the public square without a willingness to discuss the gospel too? There are some approaches to natural law that say, let's just talk about natural law and let's not mention God. Okay? Let's not talk about providence. Let's not talk about the gospel. I would say the answer is not very effectively. I won't say you can do nothing this way, but not very effectively, because among the irrational sources of our resentment against the natural law is that we lack the grace to obey it. If you don't know about the possibility of forgiveness, the natural law, any law, seems to be a heartless demand that you cannot obey. It has a heart of stone. It just accuses you. Paradoxically, then, even though it has been said that, you know, natural law is a sort of a preamble to faith, maybe in a psychological rather than a logical sense, faith may almost be a preamble to recognition of the natural law. It gets us over that block. The third, can resentment against natural law be removed then by invoking the gospel too? Well, in the long run, among those who yearn for God, yes. But otherwise, no, because the appeal to grace itself unleashes irrational resentment. We resist the natural law in part because we cannot obey it, that's what I said, but if we do not desire to obey it, then accepting the offer of divine assistance may seem not like liberation, but like ignominious surrender to a foe. Not without reason, then, did St. Thomas Aquinas follow his great treatise on law in the Summa Theologiae with his treatise on grace. Because it's not enough to offer rational arguments to a mutinous world, although we cannot do without them. We cannot just offer rational arguments expecting them to be heard just because they are rational. A delicate diplomacy is needed, a kind of diplomacy of the heart, a kind of a negotiation, not only with the mind, but with that refractory heart that tempts it to be less refractory. More than that, I think, and this is about us, the envoy must abandon himself to the Father of Lights, without whom all peacemaking fails, without whom there is no illumination. So as he appeals to his fellow citizens, so he has to entrust himself to their author, praying in love not only for their illumination, but for his own. Thank you.
I was wondering, is talking about the marriage thing, is there an extent to which
that in a sense it's the echoes of grace in nature that's actually causing some of the disruption? I'm thinking mostly of my conversations with friends in which we've been arguing about gay marriage, and it is justified almost purely on the basis of marriage as romantic attachment.
Yeah.
So if in a sense Christianity has emphasized or added this especially romantic aspect to marriage, then it seems like it's actually that in the disruption, that aspect of it is almost an engine without a governor that is shaking apart the natural machine of marriage.
Yes. I think that's exactly true, and that's but one of many ways in which I think a lot of our God-given equipment, the anticipation of grace, Godward longing, can become a not so divine madness. All right, because we have this longing. It is really the strongest of our longings, although it is often unrecognized. And if we expect, for instance, mere sex to satisfy the Godward longing that is connected with sex and connected with other longings too, like the longing for knowledge, the longing for beauty, we're going to be frustrated. We're going to be disappointed. We're going to be angry, and it will take increasingly perverse forms. You know, there's no good thing in us that can't go wild like this. I've tried to argue in some of my writings that even conscience can go wild and drive us into further wrongdoing, but that's another story. Yes, I agree with you, sir. Thank you.
Thanks for a great lecture.
Thanks.
I'm curious if there's a historical aspect, do you think, to natural law, in the sense that it seems to me like the last great flourishing of natural law thought seemed to come in the wake of the Holocaust. I wonder if it's almost you that steer into the abyss before you
Okay, I think we need to make a distinction. That's a very good question, but I think we need to make a distinction. The natural law cannot change. These are the principles of our flourishing. This is the law written in our heart. But on the other hand, our understanding of it can. Everyone knows, as I said, deep down, for instance, the wrong of deliberately taking innocent human life. But there may be many corollaries of that you don't know. You may not fully grasp the depth of it. You may not realize that you're implicated in that. As Thomas Aquinas said, you can't. The knowledge of the basic principles, the general principles of the natural law, is the same for everyone, both as to rectitude and as to knowledge. In other words, it's not only right for everyone; it's really at some level known to everyone. But we can. But the knowledge of the details can be flushed out of your mind. And there may be certain forms of pedagogy, certain historical experiences, certain experiences of grace, certain horrible experiences, which can drive the awareness of some of these things back into our mind. You mentioned the Holocaust. Yeah, I think that's true. Although without grace, one has to be very, very careful too, because horrible experiences may drive you toward greater craziness, as the gentleman over here was talking about. Have I answered your question?
Yes. Thank
you. Okay, good.
Thank you for that lecture. I was sort of wondering, you were talking about the city of man as sort of being natural and then the city of God being grace. But isn't for Augustine, and I'm not an expert on Augustine or anything, but isn't for Augustine the city of God the church and heaven and the city of man
the earthly community without grace.
It's doomed to hell.
So yeah, yeah.
He goes through several books talking about how they don't even achieve natural virtue for him.
Yeah, and but yes, I was taking a certain liberty in adapting Augustine's language here for talking about this. You're right, so you've caught me. But but I think I'm justified because it's also Thomas Aquinas' insight that even though we can speak of the natural virtues after the fall, we can't even fully achieve and hold on to the natural verses without supporting grace. You can't get any, you know, even a ghost of the infused virtues without grace. But he says the support of even the natural virtues depends on grace. We keep slipping beneath them. We keep slipping beneath them. And that's the problem with the city of man.
Thank you very much. On the way to this conference this morning, I wasn't sure what building it was in. It's actually a different building. And there was another conference going on.
I didn't see the posters, okay.
And so I asked the gal, do you know if there's another conference on the Common Good? And it was very interesting. She said, well, we'd like to think our conference is on the Common Good. But no, I don't know if that one would differ. So I thought, you know, it's kind of an insightful comment or something that sheds light on some of these views that you were discussing. It seems like she might be somewhere along the staircase and she has this attraction to the Common Good that has this, you know, fundamentally nature, and what it means. And I'm wondering, just practically speaking, how do you address people in that sort of a situation, maybe in conversations like that? I know you had some very good comments, suggestions I thought about, you know, in loving humility, you know, pray for them and pray for the grace to illuminate them and pray for the grace to illuminate yourself in those sorts of situations. I was just wondering if you had.
Okay, thank you very much for the question. I think that even the very idea that there is a common good does reflect something of the truth. People it reflects, at least, even if the person who says this can't articulate it, the idea that we are not made for ourselves alone, that we even individually cannot flourish except in concern for others, that we're made to live in community, that somebody who says, I'm looking out for number one, is not even, in fact, successfully looking out for number one, that the good is not even good unless we pursue it in company with others. Well, that's something, isn't it? On the other hand, what happens sometimes then is we combine that with other ideas about personal autonomy or this or that or the other, or self-definition or my identity. And so we try to make up some idea of good that is not in accordance with the natural law. But, you know, even there's got to be some hope, because any distorted idea of the good, in order to be plausible to us at all, has to have some little fragment of the truth in it. C.S. Lewis is very good about this in his book, The Abolition of Man, when he says that even people who invent new moralities, as they say they're doing, the innovators, they aren't ignoring the tree of the natural law and growing a new one. What's happening is they're pulling one branch off of that and using it to beat down the other branches, and then letting that one branch grow up to a hypertrophied condition so that it looks like the whole thing. You know, the Nazi, the idea that you have special obligations to your kin, just went wild. You know, and you know, he distorts the idea of his kin, and he loses sight of the fact that in the long run that we are all kin. We are all brothers and sisters. And so I think that what works sometimes, it doesn't work always. It works to the degree that you can engage in rational conversation, all right? And sometimes you can't. But what works sometimes is to reach for that element of truth that has been distorted here and try to develop that. And usually this works better when we ask questions rather than make assertions. What do you mean by that? What this is connected with is, Augustine's been mentioned here a couple of times, the privation theory of evil. You know, evil isn't a substance. Evil isn't a thing in itself. You can never come up with a wholly wrong, you know, morality that hasn't a grain of truth in it. Evil is always an error. Error is always a disorder in one's perception of the truth. Evil is always something of the good that ought to be there but isn't. And that in no way lessens the evil of evil, but it explains how it works. So if we can redeem, if we can recover those almost lost elements of truth in the erroneous conception, that's very good. I say, when rational conversation is possible, it isn't always possible. But you know, there are rational responses that we can give sometimes even to the irrational. A student said to me in class once, he was getting really angry with me. And I was saying something fairly innocuous. I was talking about Aristotle or somebody. And he was getting really angry. And I said, why are you angry? Well, I noticed that you're very angry. And he said, I'm sorry, Texas students are very courteous. So he said, I'm sorry. And I said, no, you misunderstand me. I'm not scolding you. You don't have to apologize to him. It's just that I noticed that you're angry and I'm wondering why. He said, well, I guess it's because I don't like what you're saying. And I said, well, then, but what about this? You know, there are, why don't you like what I'm saying? He said, because I think you're wrong. And I said, but you know, there are a lot of people whom I think are wrong, and I don't get angry with them. I think that Jehovah's Witnesses are wrong about blood transfusions, and I don't get angry with Jehovah's Witnesses. So there must be something wrong, something more than just you thinking that I'm wrong. What do you think that is? And he said, you're right, I don't know what it is. And I said, then what we really have to think about is not why I'm wrong or why you're right or whether I'm right, but why you're angry. And maybe we can get further there. So that's a rational response to something irrational that may open a window at some future time.
Hi, thank you for a great lecture. I had a question about natural law and sort of alternative delivery mechanisms that I've run into just across my time reading about it. You know, given how far our political and social discourse is from even nodding at natural law, I was curious what you think of some projects. I think Larry Arnhart is one who tries to marry things like science and evolutionary psychology with natural law theory and make some sort of a synthesis that can appeal non-religiously to the average.
Oh my gosh, don't get me started on Larry Arnhart and the evolutionary psychologists. No, I think that stuff is really dreadfully, dreadfully wrong. You notice it's very funny. People will always say, well, evolution teaches us, and then they'll all come up with something different. Usually it's some form of utilitarianism. Not always. What happens is it isn't actually that natural history is teaching them anything. What's happening is that they're observing things around them. Larry Arnhart, for instance, observes that he claims that that human beings are almost but not quite monogamous. Okay? which he makes a natural law, which is convenient, and then tries to come up with an evolutionary scenario that could have explained it. How did we come out that way? Which is all completely fictitious, of course you don't know. So they're not actually coming up with any new ideas. They're merely delivering their own prejudices and sometimes observations in the covering of a popular scientific theory. I think that needs to be engaged. I think what we can do is say, all right, let's talk about natural law. Would it be a natural law just because we evolved this way? On your premises, man is merely the meaningless and purposeless result of a process that did not have him in mind. So conscience, for instance, as a wife murderer named George DeLury once wrote in a book after he got out of prison, that for months after the deed, he felt extreme pangs of remorse. He could hardly stand it. And he said, but then he realized that he didn't have to feel this way. It was meaningless because it was merely an echo of the primate inhibition against taking the life of one's own kind. So, you know, to explain it in terms of evolution and so forth is actually to explain it away. In order, that scenario, even if it were true, would not explain the distinctive feature of conscience, which is that we experience it as the voice of God. And it's not just like an instinct, something that pushes us to do something and we can't help it, or an inhibition keeps us from doing it and we can't help it. We even may fight against our inherited or genetic impulses and inhibitions and say, I really want to do this, but it would be wrong. Or I don't want to do this, but I should. And, you know, none of these things can be explained by that scenario. But I think we can engage with those people.
Hi, thank you for being here today. I was interested to hear that you have a book called Natural Law for Lawyers, and I plan to check that out. I'm a practicing lawyer here in Boston, and throughout your talk, all I could think about was my pro bono immigration cases. I represent a few kids in deportation proceedings, and the immigration apparatus in this country is monstrous and impenetrable. And these children who were brought here or smuggled here are in deportation, and it seems to me such a manifestly unjust and bad outcome to separate them from their family members here and send them back into violent situations. But in the face of this bureaucracy, I confess that I sometimes despair, because despite any appeal you might make to justice or, you know, a better outcome for the child, there isn't much you can do. So I was wondering if what you might advise to practicing lawyers, how, as to your first question on natural law in the public square, how might we bring to bear some of these principles in our practice, just from a practical standpoint?
Well, you know, the part of the difficulty of the natural law in cases like this is that it provides us with general principles. Even the remote implications of the general principles are still pretty general. It's one thing to know, for instance, that I shouldn't murder. It's another thing to know that I have to show respect to the agent. That's a much more remote implication. And then when it comes down to most of the kinds of details that we have to talk about in making public policy, it requires prudence to know what is appropriate in this situation, which is not always what's appropriate in another situation. This is sometimes called determination, determinatio, that you have to pin down the details of things, that which is why, although the principle that I have to have regard for the safety of my neighbor is universal, whether we should drive on the right side of the road or the left side of the road is variable. Now, as to immigration, then, this may be an unsatisfying reply because I can't give any real solutions to these heartbreaking problems. But the natural law would certainly teach that the appropriate caretakers of the child are his parents. The state can't replace them unless the parents are demonstrably, you know, incompetent and harmful to the child. That the presumption should lie there. And that's not why people are being separated in a case like that. On the other hand, it is also true that it's not unreasonable for the sake of the common good that a city protect its borders. It's not unreasonable to have border laws. Some people leap from the conclusion that there are injustices involved in that to the conclusion that borders should be entirely open and anybody should be able to move anywhere. And that, you know, that seems crazy. A moment's thought suggests all of the bad results from that. Perhaps even bad results for some of these other nations, which are relieved by that by certain kinds of unregulated immigration from having to clean up their own messes. So the difficulty is in using prudence in order to balance these things. I don't mean balance in saying how much protection of children will we have compared with how much protection of our borders. I mean balance in the sense of thinking, how can we protect children and at the same time reasonably and not unreasonably, not in a racist fashion, protect our borders. Or that I feel that myself that that's an inadequate answer, but it's about all that I can give. Okay.
Right here in the middle.
Hi. Thank you for your lecture. I enjoyed it. My question is mainly on technology. I think given the emergence of new technologies that seek to almost change human nature, like fertility treatments, like biotechnologies, even the thing like the phone that you held up, it seems less and less intuitive, at least to the average person, that human nature is something that is immutable or
yes.
Human nature, we even have a nature or...
Mm-hmm.
Epistemology, like how we figured it out. How do you, as Christians who hold natural law and believe in it, how do you recommend us navigating that world?
I think you're quite right that a lot of this technology makes us believe that we can change human nature, and we can't. The way that the technology does that is that it sometimes, and I'm talking about not just electrical technology like a cell phone or chemical technology like a contraceptive pill, but social technologies like the all-embracing welfare state make us believe that we can change human nature. You know, for instance, the birth control pill seems to sever the connection between sexuality and procreation. But one of the things that most people can see, if you just discuss it a little bit past the superficial level and present things in the right way, is that our attempts to outwit the natural consequences of violation of the natural law themselves have natural consequences. Consider just the contraceptive pill. It was believed when it was brought into wide circulation that the widespread use of chemical contraception would eliminate the problem of unwed pregnancy. that there just wouldn't be any more. And of course, what actually happened is that its use contributed to a vast sea change in people's attitudes toward sexuality, so that actually out of wedlock pregnancies became skyrocketed and became much, much more common. Now to the point where even the secondary technology of the all-embracing welfare state is having difficulty coping with those consequences, and is, before too long, is just going to be fiscally impossible for it to do it, if not unmanageable in other ways, and all of that is going to collapse. So, the psalmist says, why do the nations rage? I think it's partly because their efforts to find ways around the natural law, to find consequentialist ways around. Oh, the only reason for this thing that used to be called a natural law is that it had these bad consequences. I can take care of the consequences in this other way? Well, no, we can't. I think what's going to happen, though, is and I think most people can see that. It takes a little, but they can sort of see it. They may not want to admit it in a public setting, but in one-to-one conversation over coffee, usually they can. What I'm afraid is going to happen is this. You know, we used to speak of pendulums. Do you say penduli? I guess it's pendulums. That because of the natural law, you go too far out this way, and you're going to swing back this way. You go too far this way, you're going to swing back this way. What's happening is with the result of these technologies that delay or put off or to shift onto somebody else, like the next generation, the consequences of our misdeeds, what's happening is that we're artificially pushing that pendulum up higher and higher and higher. And pretty soon it gets to the point where we can't hold it up anymore, and because it's so high, when it swings back, it's going to swing with explosive destructive force. We need to be preparing for that now, because that shattering damage is going to be enormous, even greater than what we see now while it's still up there. And we've got to be ready to help to mop up the pieces. I like to quote a line from T.S. Eliot about the delusion that we can defeat the witness of natural consequences. He said, we're dreaming of systems so perfect that no one has to be good. But we have to be good.
Thinking about people falling down the staircase into the basement.
Yes.
And it occurred to me that Aristotle also has a conception of the difficulty of following the natural law unassisted. At the end of the ethics, pretty much the motivation for politics is the impossibility of one private person being another for a chance or species. Instead, it requires coercion. And Aquinas says basically the same thing is treatise on the law as well, right? That it's impossible for a private person another without some force or the force of law. And you could say even the Dominican conception of sufficient and efficacious grace has the same thing built into it, right? That when you are being virtuous, you receive that grace which is actually efficacious in making you virtuous. So I'm just wondering what role you see for coercion in the law.
Well, I think that is part of the problem. There is certainly a greater resentment toward any element of coercion in law. On the other hand, some of this worry about coercion in law is well-grounded, because we also see how dangerous coercion in law can be when the so-called laws, the edicts, are being made by unjust men who are not regarding the common good and are not regarding the natural law, but regarding what they conceive to be their own good or the advancement of their own party or whatever. Dreadful things can happen, so one can understand why people are afraid of coercion. But a degree of coercion is necessary. Now, sometimes it may be indirect. For instance, I think it would be a very bad idea under our circumstances, and I'm not saying that this was a bad thing for the ancient Hebrews, but I think it would be a terrible thing for us to stone adulterers. On the other hand, it doesn't mean that law has no function in encouraging people to keep their marital vows. The old system of divorce, by where you had to demonstrate fault, right? To get a divorce, you had to demonstrate mental cruelty or abandonment or alienation of affections or something like that. The civil law is, after all, backed up by coercion. You are directly coercing people not to commit adultery, but not to violate their marital vows. But the law was being put behind, and in an indirect way, coercion was being put behind the understanding of marriage as a relationship, which, among other things, was formed by these vows. And I think we can do that. Thomas Aquinas also talked about the fact, and this is another area where prudence is necessary, although he was unapologetic about the need for coercion, he was also very delicate. He didn't just say, go in there and hammer away. Rather, he said, you have to do what's possible. And there may be very little that you can do at first among people who are very corrupt. You have to worry about the most grievous and the most damaging vices and try to do those things that will not make people break out into yet greater evils. I agree with him.
Well, we're going to have to end this session there. Let's give our thanks.